Before I say my own words of welcome, let me read the lessons for the day. It comes from Luke Gospel, chapter 15, a very familiar parable for all of us. Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to the father, Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me. So he divided the property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country, and there he squandered his property with dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare, but here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired hands. So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his slaves, Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound. Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never have given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. And then the father said to him, Son, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. We believe this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, enough about the journey yesterday. I could have gone to Tokyo in less time. But I'm here and I'm rested and I'm anxious to be a part of this service of worship with you. I do express some hesitant gratitude for being here. Just short of 3 years ago, I was contacted to ask if I would be willing to come to Epworth and be a preacher for the weekend. And I reminded the person who asked me that I was just about to be 80 years of age. And no one that old should ever be invited to take a long trip like this to preach. He was rather persistent. So then I looked up Epworth and saw the roster of great preachers who have stood here before you, and I was candidly intimidated and thought that would be a good excuse to say no. He continued to persist. So after some time, I began to think about the reality of what I might say that would be helpful to you, but more so to me. I've discovered after 55 years of preaching that God is a God of great mercy and forgiveness, and a God of grace. God can use the feeble words of a feeble preacher so long as the listener can employ the element of grace in listening. So for what it's worth, I accepted the invitation to think more deeply about those two subjects, God's grace and God's forgiveness. All of it caused me to look back to a book that I have read years ago by Philip Yancey, with the title, What is So Amazing About Grace?, the title of this sermon. And the first thing that I did in my thinking about today was to glance with my eyes over both Testaments, the Old and the New, to see what character might dance off the stage of the pages of those two Testaments, who might serve as a kind of perfect specimen for us to consider. It became obvious that there were there those characters who accepted God's grace, and there were those who rejected God's grace. The names are familiar to us: Abraham, Moses, David, Jonah, Ruth, Naomi. And there was John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus. You recall that he was put in prison, and he was concerned that maybe Jesus was not the one who was promised. And so from his prison cell, he sent emissaries to Jesus asking, "Are you the one, or shall we look for another?" I thought that might be a character to talk about God's grace and forgiveness. Then I glanced for a moment at Judas. Judas, as you know, was the betrayer. And then I thought perhaps we might look at Thomas the doubter. And then my eyes kept looking. Maybe Paul, the denier, Thomas the doubter, Paul, the persecutor, and a host of nameless ones. They're all over the pages of the New Testament. The rich young ruler who loved his possessions more than he loved God. I'm always struck by the 10 lepers. 9 didn't even take time to say thank you for the miracle of healing. I always wonder what went on in the mind of the high priests, Caiaphas, the scribes, the religious lawyers. But the longer I began to contemplate what might be said about grace and forgiveness, my eye could not leave the pages of chapter 15 in Luke's gospel. I found there the nameless prodigal son and his brother, the perfect ones who could be put under the spotlight. One son accepted God's grace. The other son rejected it. All of us here are familiar with that parable, but I'm wondering if our familiarity has caused us to forget what the parable is really about. It's not about two sons. It's about a father. A father who acts exactly like God. It's about a God who shows grace in the midst of great sin, and a God who offers forgiveness in the midst of it. You know, it appears, this parable, in the 15th chapter of Luke, along with two other stories, one, the lost sheep and the lost coin, and the lost son. They all make the same point. At the end, when they are found, there is a moment of great celebration. And I believe that the stories are really not about two sons or coins or sheep. They're really about God. God is not a distant figure who wants us sometimes to hide in the closet as if we're afraid of God. No, God is like a very loving parent. No matter what we do, God still loves us. Jesus reminds us in this parable of the great humiliation that the father suffers during this period of time when his prodigal son goes away into the distant land. I like to read scripture with my eyes and imagination both working at the same time. Here's a son who discovers that he is ashamed of himself and he's embarrassed and almost afraid to come home. And then I turn and look at the father. Can you imagine how many days and weeks and months and maybe years this father looked out of the picture window of his house waiting for some evidence that this son would return? And then one day he does. And the father, staring out the window, runs down the path toward the house. And he sees his son and he grasps him and loves him. If you've been a parent, I ask you to think about how you would have treated your own child. I'm 80 years old, so I can make a confession. I made lots of mistakes with our two daughters. Probably you've made this same mistake. I remember once when our younger daughter did something that wasn't the right thing to do, and I scolded her, and I said, "I do hope you finally learned your lesson." Or once I remember saying, "I know it didn't hurt you nearly as much as it hurt me." There's no forgiveness in that, is there? There's no love in that. The Father offers no condemnation, no conditional forgiveness, no withholding of love. Instead, it's a moment of exhilaration. This my son was dead and he's alive. He was found. He's here. Let's have a party. How many parents do you know have acted that way? But then tragically, in the middle of this parable comes this older brother who steps on the stage. No doubt Jesus introduces him to remind us, if you will, please don't be offended. No doubt Jesus introduces him to remind us of how much like him we have all been at times. Can't you hear this older brother shouting at his father? All these years I have served you like a slave. I've never disobeyed you even once, and yet you never threw a party for me and my friends. And then listen to what he says. This young son of yours, not my brother, this young son of yours has embarrassed our family. It's grace at its very best when you lead into the theme of the great parable. Remember what the father said to the brother? This brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. We must celebrate. That's what's amazing about God's grace. And now to Philip Yancey. If you've not read the book, I commend you. You can get it very easily. What is so amazing about grace? In the book, he tells of a young teenage girl from Traverse City, Michigan. She believed her parents were old-fashioned. They tended to overreact to her nose ring and the music she listened to and the gang she was always with and the clothes she always wore. So one day she decides to leave. She runs away from home, all the way from Traverse City to Detroit. She immediately falls victim to an older man who drives a car, the biggest car she has ever seen in her life. And he befriends her. He buys her fancy clothes. He gets her a nice place to live. He gives her pills that made her feel better than she'd ever felt before in her life. And gradually, you can imagine, she becomes a woman for hire. But eventually, as it seems always to happen, she became more and more unattractive because of the drugs she was using. And so the generous man dumped her and moved her out of the apartment, and she was abandoned to the streets. She was left to go from bad to worse. She lived in fear every day that someone was going to kill her. And then one day she sees her picture on the back of a milk carton that she found in a trash can. Slowly she remembers how much better she looked when she lived with her parents. Then winter blows in and she finds herself sleeping on a metal grate outside of a department store, even in Detroit, where they had stores heated by steam back then. That's the only way she could stay warm. One morning, rising from the steam grate, she looks into the window of the store and she sees herself. Dark circles almost covered her eyes completely. She was dirty. She'd not had a bath in weeks. She has a constant cough and she knows she's sick. She begins to whimper and she has very little money left. She's very hungry. It's then that she begins to remember Traverse City like a prodigal son remembering home. She's terrified and she cries out for all to hear, "God, oh God, why did I ever leave home? Even my dog eats better than I do. Why did I ever leave home?" And now she knows more than anything else she wants to go home. She makes 3 straight phone calls. The first 2, she gets the answering machine. She doesn't leave a message. The 3rd call she makes, she gets the answering machine and she leaves this message: "Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus and will arrive at midnight tomorrow. And if you're not there at the bus station, I will know that you do not want to see me ever again. And if that's the case, I'll just stay on the bus and go on to Canada." The bus ride, because of the multi-stops from Detroit to Traverse City, takes 7 hours. And all the way there, she keeps thinking, what if they're away? What if they didn't get my message? Or maybe more so, what if they're so embarrassed that they really don't want to ever see me again? And all the way home, she rehearses her speech. Dad, I'm so sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's mine. Dad, can you ever forgive me?" Finally, the bus arrives at the station and the driver announces, "Traverse City, next stop, just 15 minutes and the bus will leave for Canada." She sits on the bus. She thinks to herself, 15 minutes to decide her life for her whole future. She gets on the bus and does not know what to do, but slowly as she decides to step off the bus, she walks very hesitantly into the terminal, knowing not anything might happen. But almost immediately she sees 40 people, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncle, a grandmother, all wearing goofy party hats, blowing noisemakers, and taped on the wall was a huge banner with these words on it: "Welcome home. Welcome home." She stares at the crowd, searching for her father, searching, and finally she sees him as he runs toward her and hugs her, and she slowly begins her memorized speech. Dad, I'm so sorry. I know it's my fault." But immediately he interrupts her. "Hush, child. We've not any time for that kind of talk. You were lost. You're home. No time for apologies. We will be late if we do not leave immediately for our celebration party." Now, I don't know what you think about that, but every time I read that story aloud in my office, I am moved by it because it actually did happen, even to one of our childs. It happened. The joy of welcoming a child home is beyond anything that we could compare. That's what's so amazing about grace, isn't it? Grace teaches us that God loves us because of who God is, not because of who we are. It comes not because we're worthy, but because God knows we're unworthy. Now, last night, as I was waiting on the plane to take off, I was looking at these notes, and I thought, I better X this part out. Then this morning, after a few hours of sleep, I decided, no, I'm going to use it. Just in case any one of you here thinks you are perfect, let me dispel that illusion. No one is perfect. No one is outside the range of the need for God's forgiveness and grace. You remember Harry Beecher Stowe? She wrote a wonderful book. I read it again recently, called Uncle Tom's Cabin. In the book, there's a son that says this out loud to his mother. Don't the Bible say we must love everybody, Mom? She hesitates, and then she responds, Oh, that Bible. To be sure, it says a great many things, but nobody ever thinks of doing them. There's a lot of truth in that, isn't there? The Bible is full of imperfect people like all of us. But the ones who accepted God's forgiveness and grace are the ones who moved on to make a contribution in life. I've discovered along the way in my life that the healing power of God comes to those who welcome it, but God never coerces, God only invites. I've been enjoying something that I call retirement. This is the last gig, they say. I like reading Shakespeare. I don't understand it most of the time, but I do like reading Shakespeare. I like reading Macbeth particularly. I like it because it deals with the guilt of his wife. You remember that scene? She's sleepwalking night after night after night, and Macbeth is so disturbed he doesn't know what to do about it. And finally, whether he's on his knees or not, I don't know, or whether he's talking to God or not, I do not know. But he yells out, "Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased, pluck from the memory a rooted sorrow, raise out the written troubles of the brain, and with some sweet, oblivious antidote, cleanse the stuffed bosom of the perilous stuff which weighs upon the heart?" It's guilt. Guilt. That's why I believe in God's forgiveness and God's grace, and we all need it. I'm okay. I always worry. I've grown to be more fond of Amazing Grace, the hymn, over the last couple of decades. Some of you are younger and some of you are a little older perhaps than I am, but you know, for decades we never sang Amazing Grace in the church. And then all of a sudden it became quite popular. When Aretha Franklin sang Amazing Grace, it was from a person who had experienced that grace. You know the story of it. Newton was a slave trader, and he had a terrible, terrible storm at sea, and he thought all of the mates and the slaves were going to die, and he promised to be better, and he did. And he sat down in 1779 and wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. But back to the narrative. Bill Moyer the news commentator produced a documentary on this hymn. It's titled Amazing Grace. And in the film, there's a scene where they're at Wembley Stadium in London. Various musical groups have been invited, mostly rock bands. They were there to celebrate the changes that had occurred in South Africa after Mandela was released from 27 years in prison. For some reason, the promoters decided to have a last act, and they invited Jesse Norman. You may not know that name, but probably you do. Jesse Norman was a great opera singer. She was born in 1945 in Augusta, Georgia. And she was there as the last act. For 12 hours, rock bands like Guns N' Roses blasted the crowds through loudspeakers, riling up the fans who were already high on drugs and alcohol. The crowd yells for one more curtain call after another. Meanwhile, Jesse Norman is quietly sitting in her dressing room being interviewed by Bill Moyer. They're talking about the hymn, Amazing Grace. You know, Newton finally really received the light from God, and he became a minister. And in 1807, after joining forces with Wilbur William Force, they abolished slave trade from all of Great Britain. Back to the concert. The time finally came for Jesse Norman to sing. A single circle of light follows Norman on the stage, this majestic African-American woman wearing a flowing robe, no backup band, no musical instruments, just Jesse. The crowd was restless. A voice yells out, "Give us more Guns N' Roses! Give us more Guns N' Roses!" Others take up the crowd. The scene gets ugly, very ugly. But it did not disturb Jesse. Alone on that stage with a single light, she begins to hum and then very softly sing, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see." The remarkable thing then began to happen at Wembley Stadium as she began to raise the volume a little on the second verse. The crowd of raucous fans fell silent. Second stanza. "'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. Slowly she sang, and by the time she reached the third voice, it was louder. 'Tis grace that has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home.'" By then, several thousand raucous fans were digging back into their own memories. And they began to sing quietly the words. No one knows for sure, but is it safe to say that when they reached the final verse, something flashed back in their memory that recalled the subject at least? "'Tis grace has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me all the way home." And the last is the great one. When we've been there for 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. That's eternity. It's grace. It's amazing. Because you cannot buy it, you cannot earn it, you cannot borrow it, you cannot steal it, but once you have it, you cannot refuse to share it. That's why it's grace. Thanks be to God.